Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So it was, you know, we say, you know, cat and mouse games, but it was, you know, very often you'd come back and you would have a 7.62 nice little hole straight through the back of your G-Wagon and out the other side without you even knowing it.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list to keep up with the latest episode. In October of 2022, I was asked by the West Pennines Military Vehicle Trust to moderate a question and answer session with a number of Bricksmith veterans. Attending were drivers Neil Walton, Pete Curran, Dave Collins and Kev Smith, plus Sandy Saxton Warren, Joint Operations and Weapons, Mike Hill, Tour Officer, Mike Corcoran, Weapons, and Dave Butler, Senior Tour Officer. It was an amazing afternoon of reminiscing about their experiences and viewing the amazing collections they had from that time. Don't miss part two that follows next week. My good friend Colin Deiter helped with the complex recording of this session, but a quick note that the audio is not up to the usual quality of Cold War Conversations due to background noise, but I think the events and activities described definitely make it worth listening to. Thank you. The Cold War conversation continues in our vibrant Facebook discussion group and on Twitter. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook and we're at Cold War Pod on Twitter. Now, Cold War history is disappearing, but a simple monthly donation will help keep this podcast on the air. You'll be part of our community, you'll get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Abe Brandt, and I support the Cold War Conversations podcast financially, quite simply because it's the best history podcast out there, and I want to make sure it continues. Keep going, Ian, and thank you.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome seven Bricksmith veterans to our Cold War conversation.
So, should we start with you, Pete?
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Curran. I was a tour driver with Bricksmith from 1988 to the close of the mission in 1990.
You were RAF when you did
it.
Yeah, RAF.
Kevin Smith, I was Army tour driver at Bricksmith, 88 to 90 as well, up to the closing day.
Sandy Warren, I wasn't the driver. I worked in the weapons and the joint operations side of things. I was the only woman who worked through the grill with all the guys, so they looked after me really, really well. And I was there from 89 to 91.
Neil Walton, I was fortunate enough to get there because it was one of the drivers I had an accident by earlier and then later. And I got there in December 89, just after the war had been breached, and then stayed up until we became Joint Intelligence Service in 91. And then I left in 92. So 90 to 92, the last tour driver.
Dave Collins, Army tour driver, 88 to 90.
Bricksmith came about as a thing called the Robertson-Mallinson Agreement, okay, which was it's basically all the powers, the superpowers, after they've defeated Germany after the Second World War. As you know, what happened is there was build-up of forces, yeah, so all the powers agreed to, through this Robertson-Mallinson Agreement, which I don't know too well, but effectively it allowed, yeah, all the powers, including the Russians, yeah, to be present in each of their sectors. The French, the Americans and ourselves toured, yeah, in East Germany that was occupied by the Soviet forces. Yeah, it did not recognize East German forces.
Yes.
The NVA, National Volks Army. Yes. Did recognize it all. So we were in a privileged position at the time. So we could, for example, be on tour. Yeah. And we could be speeding.
Yeah.
As we sometimes did.
Sometimes.
Very, very seldom we did.
Yeah.
The Volkspolizei would try to, stop us. And we'd just literally, wave at them. And they were there in their little Wartburgs and their little Trabants and tried to stop a G-Wagon that weighed just short of 3 ton that was armoured up to the eyeballs and,
Fuel tanks.
Yeah, it was extra fuel tanks and all the other bits of equipment that we can go into, later on if you wish. Yeah, so that was the basis. And then I suppose all the in-between is stuff I'm sure we'll be talking about later, but at the end... Yeah, when the war came down, the result of perestroika and glasnost, the Reichsmalice and agreement failed to exist. So it was literally overnight. And I suppose one of my stories that I'd tell is the night that we received that phone call. And I was Potsdam Red at the time. And I went down to Checkpoint Bravo to pick up the commander-in-chief of the officers and also the French general. So then we met at the Glinica Bridge for a closing down ceremony. And it was literally as fast as that. Nobody knew about it. I mean, I was on tour when it all came out and we couldn't, this spy, the Bridge of Spies, as it's referred to now, where Gary Powers and his U2 spy plane was shot down. Obviously, left-hand side going over, it was for mission personnel, and the right-hand side was for diplomat.
Yeah.
And I was the last remaining sort of soldier, if you like, and Brix was here, was privileged to be there that night. So, and there's a few photographs in mine. Not as good as Neil's souvenirs, but they're good memories.
But the whole role of being there was that it was before the days of satellite. It was basically people on the ground.
Mm.
And it would be, if the Russians were coming, we would raise the flag and say they're coming.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was basically, so we were human intelligence on the ground. It wasn't just Brixmas, as we said, it was the French, there was the American mission, but we were the biggest mission. When they actually did the Robertson Millennium Agreement, we got the bigger percentage of individuals and we were about twice the size of the French and Americans. Something like that.
Yeah, 8 and 4. The French ended up with the least.
It was basically the guys would go out on paths. We were, as Ken just said, there were so many passes that were allocated out. It meant that not everybody was in East Germany at the same time. People were actually, we were based in West Berlin, where the Olympic Stadium is. That's where we were accommodated. We lived, married quarters were there. We did have a house in Potsdam, which was the mission house. It's still there. We don't own it anymore. We never owned it. It was loaned to us from the German government. And Herr Duke bought it when it went to auction after Duke, the designer, Duke, the aftershave guy. He bought it up until and he sold it recently. The guys would have pass and there would be a driver. There would be a tour NCO and a tour officer that would go out on tour. And it could be an air tour or it could be an army tour. And that's how we were a dual service. We were, it's one of the only units that was pure army and RAF. We had one Navy guy, he arrived, but then the top part of Germany, which where we had the coast, then went to TRA. So we couldn't go anymore. So there was no point, but he bimbled around, didn't he?
Yeah.
So the tours would go out and there would be intelligence gathering missions allocated, and that's part of the job I did. There would be allocations, right? We've got intel that there's this, go and have a look. But obviously, you'd go out for how many days at a time?
It could be, three, four, five, six. But as I said to Sandy coming this morning, swinging the lamp as you do, I remember on a tour, my very first tour with a guy called Captain Tim Townley, rest in peace, he's dead. And we ran into a Warsaw Pact exercise and literally we were extended for 12 days. Because it wasn't restricted area when we went in, so they used to impose what they used to call a temporary restricted area.
Yeah.
So we were in that area because we had no communications.
Strictly.
And we were just extended.
So the only communication we had was a beeper. You'll see one of the actual rear one that we had then. That was it. The beeper used to go off. We'd have to go to a phone, an East German phone, and call in. We had different code words. Op radiator was a breakdown, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you'd have a breakdown. But op radiator didn't actually mean a breakdown. It meant that there was kit out there.
That's right.
So they would then send another T. So you'd bring, if there was a breakdown, you'd bring another G-Wagon on the back of a trailer. So there's a little model over there of a trailer with one on the back. So we used to do different duties. So we had the duty driver, which Kev's alluded to, he was on that night, which is a white van. We've seen the white picture of the white van on the side there. It's a little van we used to drive around in it with a caddy Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Then we had the senators. Then we had the G wagons as well. Guys, before I got there, had the Range Rovers and Audi quite a lot tested out. The G wagons quite the best, weren't they? For not local, the senators were better for local. So that meant that we weren't going to go on deep tack routes, so we didn't need full rally spec, which we had. We had them both vehicles, but you would be able to get along Satscorn ramp in the Senator. You'd have to go in a G-Wagon. And even then, officers still managed to get us bogged in when we'd say, it's too wet, we're not going in there, boss. And they'd go, I want to go in there. And you'd go, well, tourist rules, if it's a new officer. And they said, what do you mean tourist rules? Well, if we get bogged in, you get out, get the turf, a winch out and everything else. And that's what we did, wasn't it? And they put it back to front, so you'd have to go out and help them and get money anyway, things like that. But like Sandy says, we had no communications. So it was, and as soon as you made a phone call anyway, the Stasi had all the phone networks done. So it'd be a race to come. There was one interesting night we broke down at Finsterbau, not on top of a big bund. And we were watching there at night time, watching them loading onto a railings near Finsterbau, there it was, which was an air place. And they were loading this kit on, and then we finished what we were doing. It was dark, and then they said, right, on we go then. It wouldn't start, just for no reason. Batteries were left on or nothing else, just wouldn't go. And we got, it's not kicking over, wouldn't start over. And we're at the top of this sort of 40-meter, really steep bund. No communications. I was with John Buchan at the time. And they got out, and I said, well, you get out, and I'll just have to put it in neutral and just go back. Whatever he brakes or whatever he's steering, we'll just have to go down, and it goes down at the bottom there, but there's a railway hut. So you'll have to go down and chat to the railway man, otherwise he'll run over and tell them what's going on. So they went down, chatted up the railway man. I went down like that, holding on to this, and it looked like a fire break. So if you'd gone over, you'd have tipped over, like, so just held it steady, off we went. We did training for that kind of stuff anyway. So we did it up in Teufelberg, didn't we?
Yeah.
And they used to take us up that. Got over there, and then John had to hitch a ride with a railway man into PRA, permanent restricted area, and make a phone call to get us recovered in that. Because you've got to be not just for that, but on the end of that as well. So
I think from a background perspective as well, it'd be useful for you to see one of the maps, what we used to call the PRA map, okay, which is shades of dark orange and white. And basically, if it was orange, it would be permanent restricted area.
So we knew that they'd got kit in there.
Yeah. So that would be the nuclear, biological, chemical, and spectral forces,
all the yellow areas
and
permanent restricted areas.
Yeah. And it's also probably kind of to mention the fact that, you know, the whole of DDR,
Democratic
Republic,
all real stuff, it's big stuff.
East Germany, you'll probably find a lot of our screenshots and everything else is marked on there, as well as drivers normally did. But what that area represented was our tour area.
Yeah.
And what we used to have, so as soon as we booked out at West Berlin, where we were all housed with our families, we used to go over the Glinica Bridge into the Mission House, okay, where we used to have the inevitable piece of pie and a coffee before we went out. And when we went out on the motorway, at various points on the motorway, bearing in mind East Germany was probably the least mapped area in Europe at the time, okay? And we used to actually do a thing called a mapping tour. So where new roads had appeared, you wouldn't be able to, you know, our maps were so far out of date, so we turn out a mapper. But at various points, strategic points, they used to put out the MFS, which is the Ministerium für Staatssicherheit. Now, they were the secret police. And the people in East Germany were absolutely petrified of the MFS, whereas we literally, I mean, I could tell you some stories, but probably not for now, but where we used to literally, if we didn't recognize them, they thought we didn't know that they were there, but we used to have a book with every single number plate. Then he got announced to change the number plate when they were following us. So, you know, the tour officer would say, oh, registration number such and such, the tour senior NCO would say, yeah, we've got one. And they would literally be, you know, there like little dummies, and they wouldn't look at you at all. It was so bizarre. It was, couldn't be the other way. They would look at you. Everybody else would look at you and go, oh, Mercedes G-Wagon in East Germany. And then go, you know, some would wave at you, but the MFS would, it was really bizarre. But yeah, so, and they'd report you in. So things that we used to get up to, and again, everybody used to do it, is they used to sweep, for example, on training areas, a brush of sand. So they used to know our tire tracks. So they'd know we were in the area. And it would be around airfields, yeah, where we would camp overnight, yeah, near the centre line, yeah, in which to be able to, we'd have a number of targets, for example. So TASMs, tactical air surface missiles, or whatever it may be. We'd be on ranges, which was very dangerous because there'd be unexploded munitions. We'd collect, you know, the remnants of any missiles that were dropped by the MiGs and all the rest of it. So, yeah. And again, the whole area, you know, the MFS, the East German Army, not so much. I mean, they were very much in the, you know, armed or, I don't know, supplied with first generation Soviet equipment. Like, for example, the fish beds, which was in the, whatever it was, 27s, whatever it was.
The oldest.
And the oldest planes. And I'll just give you an example of that. When we was at an area now, the East Germans used to practice defense nuclear, biological and chemical warfare procedures. And one of those things was when a nuclear weapon ignited, so to speak, yeah, there'd be a flash. Yeah. Then there'd be a period of quiet. Yeah. Where at this time, you know, the nuclear cloud is gathering all the dust, and then, well, obviously there's a wind. And what they used to do is they used to have a big, if you remember this, guys, they used to have a big tower. Yeah, and they used to basically put lots and lots and lots of kerosene in there, and they'd be walking, doing their patrols, and then somebody'd light this ball. Yeah, so it pitch black, all of a sudden, big. That would replicate, you know, a nuclear blast. And they would literally crouch down and put their ponchos over their heads, not that that's going to make a lot of difference in a nuclear blast. But I remember, literally, we were furtling through. Furtling. Now, that's another word that I need to explain. So furtling is basically at a speed where it was walking speed, furtling through, so as not to, you know, miss anything that the Soviets might have left behind. And we were furtling through, and I said to the tour officer at the time, and I think it was Martin Breed, I think it was, and passing him, bless him, rest in peace, Ian. And he said, what's all these potato bags doing in these fields? He went, put your bloody foot down now. So, never ask questions, put your foot down. Yeah, and all these potatoes, yeah, sacks, grew legs and started running after us. And it was the most that was sort of things that we used to come back and say, sort of.
What a signing of say there.
Six,
we went over the bridge. We had two fuel tanks in the G-Wagon. So we had those special cars. So we had lights as well that you could switch, and we could just have infrared so we could see them, and they'd have to need infrared to see us. Or we could put one light on the front, one light on the back, so we look like a motorbike, and we could have total blackness. We had PNGs, night vision goggles, something to drive with because it didn't really assess depth, holes. So you have to drive 9 minutes. That's a hole.
Yeah.
And things like that. But also we had double fuel tanks in the G-Wagon. So it filled up on one. It was actually two. So it didn't have one on either side. We didn't want them to know that. So we'd be getting followed by them fart bugs, and they wouldn't do it. They had these fuel coupons. This is a brand new one, which I still smell it for 5 years old, 1990s. And we'd have to go and fill up at the East German. Remember the old lads used to go and fill up at the East German thing. So they know how much fuel we took on, but we'd always go out full anyway. But many a time you're getting followed by an ARC, and then they'd peel off because we just go across structure, or they couldn't keep up with for the fuel. The pass period Sandy was on about, he used to go on pass period. So this is your Russian pass. You'd see all the stuff up then. But you got that, and you go on, I think it used to go on 30 days at a time, wasn't it?
I think it were, yeah.
So you go for 6 weeks, I think it was.
Or was it a month or three?
We have the site.
We have three. It was brilliant, because you got 100 Deutschmarks a night if you're on pass. So, and the drivers, we had it rough. We had to sleep inside the vehicle where all the tour NCOs and that were outside in the snow. And that we had a, what was the engine? The little heater we had, what to call
it? Potentially.
Yeah, what was it called? A diesel heater.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
It was basically
Obaf, but it used to go off in the morning. You'd set that. And so we used to make a bedboard. So you had the G-Wagon and there's certain things the driver had to do when he got there. You had to make a bedboard and you had to get a pot. I've still got the curry pot. I haven't brought that today. I've only brought what I could find quickly. But a curry pot, because we used to keep curries. And a bedboard was a bit of wood. But imagine you're in your vehicle, all the space there, you made this board and that's what you're going to sleep on.
I think things as well with the G-Wagon, it only had three seats.
Well, yeah.
It had two at the front and one was central at the back. So your tour officers sat in the back so they could see straight through. Somebody got clear views.
You can't,
so weren't that, forced
on the right.
They were adopted, yeah.
Camera bags on the right. Just that green bag over there for all the cameras and no new telescopes and everything else. And on the left, you had all the flasks, which again, we had a special job where we had to heat all the water in the morning, didn't we? Six flasks for us. So we always had our water there and just get the brews out whenever we could stop. So we were pretty much on the go. You were pretty much driving for 8-9 hours, if you will, with Givo. And the guy who wrote that book over there never used to let you take a shortcut through PRA. Even if it was a 2Ks, he'd make you drive 5 hours around and that. And, so depending who you were with, if they wanted to take the thing, but you just start hitting curbs and that, and then you get a brew because they pull over and they're like,
you get those instances in life where you reflect on. And one of the my after dinner things was when, I can't remember sidings, I can't remember. But basically, we used to have thermal imaging equipment and image intensifiers, so infrared and thermal imaging, for the trains that used to go by to be able to monitor what equipment was coming in and out of East Germany at the time, from Poland, et cetera, et cetera. And on this particular occasion, we was in a really bad area, I remember. And he said, just take the MVGs, Kev. So it was a time where we was issued the MVG Mark IIs, can remember it. So we used to have two. The MVG Mark I was what we used to call Cyclops. And that was really bad. Or you could see the lady in front of you, but as Neil alluded to earlier, you didn't get any depth. So you'd literally be, and we got the RAF, you know, on the stereo. But then they got the RAF ones, which was significantly better. Because we're army, we usually pay second to
an RAF boot.
And an RAF boot, because they were more comfortable. this particular night, the guy said to me, he said, just take the MVGs, Kevin, go and do your number two elsewhere. So literally, as you do, we used to get out. We used to be very careful because noise, as you know, if night travels, is one of the key things in soldiering, if you like. You learn that you can hear someone shutting a door from half a mile away. So literally we would go click, click.
Yeah.
And we always used to have the G-Wagon key, a spare one, on the shoelace.
Yeah.
Well, locked the door, went off to do, leave the rest to your imagination. And as I was perched against a tree doing what I did, or doing what comes naturally, I saw all these black things. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. There must have been about 12 people watching me.
Yeah.
On the toilet. Yeah. And I had to sort of like literally finish what I finished, do what you do, cover what you do, and then go back. And literally, I was with the chief at the time. Oh, yeah. We used to tour in the Senator as well now and again, which wasn't as comfortable as the Geländewagen. But Chief Bricksmith, who was a brigadier at the time, Brigadier Freer, and literally got in the vehicle, started it up. I mean, there was pans all around. And he said, what are you doing? I've got soup all over my house. And we look behind you now. And there was 12 MFS and was filming them, if you like. Yeah, all running after.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was real
cloak and dagger cops and robbers type stuff. And I suppose one of the things that I suppose we've all been in a position where they would, there's been two unfortunate incidents in the mission life. A guy called Colonel Morrison, who died as a result of a shooting. He came over a Soviet wall and he was shot in the back.
Nicholson, American.
And he basically bled out. They wouldn't let the driver out and administer first aid. And the other one was a guy called Moriarty, which is a French driver, and he was rammed by a Ural 375, I believe it was. It's outside a barracks. Nobody knew why he never moved, but literally the Ural sideswiped him and he died. So it was, we say, cat and mouse games, but it was, very often you'd come back and you would have a 7.62 nice little hole straight through the back of your G-Wagon and out the other side without you even knowing it. Okay, unless until such time you opened up your sleeping bag, which was stored in the, in the side in nets. It happened to me on two occasions, but I know that a guy called Kev Powell, again, rest in peace, Kevin, and we were falling like flies, we are in Britain. And he was regularly coming in, as were the other drivers who did the, the one-offs. The one thing that we always used to get told in Brixmas is never ask, if you didn't know. And they'd say, so we would drop them off at night, the tour NCO, the tour officer. And there was many times they would say, right, Kevin, you know where the ERVs are, emergency rendezvous, and we'd have two or three. So if we got spooked by the Sobs or the East Germans, respectively, we would go and we would meet probably 5-6 hours later with the tour NCO and the tour officer, who obviously had to make their way to the ERV places. And that was quite, on those occasions, you never asked, but it was all about, even now to this day, I've never asked, what they used to get up to. A lot of the time they used to get up and they used to be on rubbish dumps looking, because the Soviets were just throwing their stuff away.
They are in Ukraine.
Yeah, and they are in Ukraine, and they were never issued with toilet paper. So on the exercise areas when we used to visit after a Soviet deployment, we, the driver, obviously, we would be out the cupola cover, looking around, making sure nobody was around. Yeah, and the tour officer and tour senior NCO would be out with rubber gloves. Okay, a plastic suit or whatever. I can't remember what they used to have, a body suit, was it an NBC suit, I think? And they would be looking in feces, for the codes that had been sent over the, over the radio and decrypted and used as toilet paper because they weren't issued toilet paper. So a lot of our defense intelligence in London used to get bags and bags of feces with a lot of uncoded messages. Yeah, that saved us a lot of time on, intelligence elsewhere.
T.A. Emanuel as well. I got a T.A. Emanuel from that first time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And after at the end, we can imagine what we did.
We got Dave.
In civilians in our cars when they said, you can go out and just go touring.
Dave Butler, I think.
And that's
Dave.
What we did. Yeah. Sort of going out trying to get
stuff. It is Dave.
That's Dave Butler.
But we also, when we had tasks, you had to go to that, we had a Soviet external relations branch. We had to report in there. Before you were going anywhere and back. So you'd take a briefcase in really thin and you'd come out with a briefcase really fat because it was full of things that you'd swap. So you'd go to the Polish market, get a really cheap headset and cassette player for 5 Deutschmarks, and you would give that to a Russian and you'd get something like this. All very small sizes because that's all they could get out of the stores, but they're all brand new, small sizes, original Corfel wallet written on there. So they would come out, wouldn't we, swap stuff, badges and boots and everything. So that's, you couldn't just go and get this stuff as freely as you can now.
There are a few people joining now, obviously, who don't live local or like within a 2-hour span like we do. In top left is Mick Hill. He's actually joining us from Canada. He lives in Ontario, so he's setting his alarm clock this morning. The Coal Cave, top right hand side. Mike Corcoran, he was my boss. In there, we've got Jean, bottom right. Jean was there. She was the chief's PA in the 70s. And then we've got Mr. Butloff, Dave Butloff, on the left-hand side. Dave was a tour senior officer and Mika was tour officer top left.
That's indeed. When we watched this TV, did a big documentary.
Yes.
On the War Channel,
The War Channel.
And Mr. Butloff, Dave Butler did that one. So obviously these guys have joined us remotely. The guys can hear us as well. I've checked with Mick, they can hear us. So do you want to start here?
Yes. A question.
bought out panel. What were your favourite units? What units did you come from? Get onto the mission.
Royal Court. Well, Aria.
How smart I have this.
Go on,
that I'll tell, namely, I'm fighter jet units. So I was doing refueling and things like that on the aircraft.
Royal Corps Transport, we were, weren't we?
Yeah, we had a staging.
We had a staging post called 8th Regiment RCT, located in Munster, former West Germany. And that was where a lot of the vetting to top secret, which you needed to go to Brixmas, carried out. And that staging post would last anywhere between 6 months and 2 years, as I did 2 years at 8th Regiment. But all the drivers, certainly I do, came from 8th Regiment.
To be qualified up to sergeant. So I was a Lance Corporal.
Were you a corporal when you went?
I was a full corporal. I was a Lance Corporal. There was three of us. There was an unfortunate accident that got me out there because one of our drivers did a U-turn and a Trabant plane. I'm not sure. Did the driver die?
It was, I don't think the driver died, but the Trabant died. I think Dave might know this, but it was, they basically took the lights off when doing a 180 on a unfenced middle carriage motorway. And the trailer, number 13, they were on a recovery at the time, I believe. And they were doing a 180 and the Trabant went into it. And I believe killed the East German. I don't know whether or not that was a kill tax, right?
Brave toppers in the engine. You'll know more about that. But yeah, so that's what got me there, because that driver was left the mission, and that's why I'm the last one in. Yeah. It was fortunate for me. But we had to be qualified to sergeant, German colloquial. So you see the German books on the side there.
Yeah.
And being a hoarder, that's all my original books, which is sad, isn't it? Even Pete's stuff was there as well. And from when we did our original reconnaissance course at Ashford, so you'd go on the course. You wouldn't be allowed to leave Brixmas to go on any courses because it was it's a full-time, special duties, it's called, not special forces, special duties role. But once we'd got there, you had to do your sergeant's course as well. So we'd go on a sergeant's course as a Lance Corporal, we'll want to say. You can imagine that what we got on that course, but we had to be expected to be better than anyone else. But you got to Brixmas anyway. So for RAF, I don't know what the RAF selection must be.
It was, I was staying at RAF in Tavern at the time, and a job called for air orders, saying, asking the people to do special duties. I thought, sounds interesting, so I applied. I got a clue, what here about anything? And the next thing I needed is vacancy process started, and I got grim. They really bloody grew me for 8 months. They went for 6 months. They kept going back and going back and going back. And in the end, it was a big force to Brixmas. So, what
from here? Back in the days where people were being
drawn. Wayne says, no, nothing would say it. I did. Just go.
I mean, this betting process was very robust. You've got to understand that, we were access to House Canucas, Australian, Canadian, UK, US, top secret material. And effectively, during this betting process, they could, and I know they did, go to my old schoolmaster, my next door neighbour at my mum's house to see whether or not I had any homosexual tendencies. Yeah, or I had a flair for fast cars and good-looking women and all the rest of it. Yeah, to see how vulnerable you were to being
right back to when I was 10 and I got caught pinching a bag of raisins out of William and Lowe's shop in Arbroath, and they kept saying, "Are you in trouble with the police? Are you in trouble with the police?" I don't know. I've been in trouble with the police. Think back. It was in Scotland. I had to go to a children's panel at the age of 10.
Well.
For thinking them, and it was all about that. It was because mum didn't know anything, but it was developed vetting that we had to get to. So a lot of people, when I went to 8th Reg in Munster, I went there as a lads corporal. There were a lot of corporals, which obviously tomb tapes if you want to know what in the army, and senior corporals who were still waiting to go to Brixmas. And they were like, "Well, what have you come here for?" So I'm going to Brixmas. And I went, "Yeah." So all them lot. And I went, "No, I'm going in October." No, they've been. I said, "Well, I'm on my SMQC, the senior military qualification, because we just were sergeant. I'm on it in July. I've already done my army education. I did it Belize before. I'm a German speaker anyway. So I'm going as far as I know. Maybe you've failed your vetting." And that's what it was. They never got told they failed the vetting. Paul Weston was the guy, the vetting officer at 8th Reg, still in touch with him. And that's what he said it was. But that's how we got selected.
Yeah, I was at Ministry of Defence in Whitehall. I'd done two tours there. So I just, as you do when you're in the army, you put in for a posting preference. I was coming up about a year before I was due. and I wanted to go to Berlin. I was like, I want to go to Berlin. Everybody was going, wanted to go to Hong Kong, Cyprus. Now I want to go to Berlin. And I literally, it's like the guy said, I was only vetted because I was working in main building in Whitehall. And about 8 months before I was due to go, saying, yeah, you've got Berlin. And then I'd never heard of Bricksmith. Never heard of it. As I don't think a lot of people had, unless you'd been in for a while. And then all I got told is, keep your mouth shut for 8 months and you can go. And that is a test. It was basically a test that you could keep quiet about where you were going. And then that was it.
I met a guy called John Boland. I don't know if he was there when you were there. John Boland, he was ex-Britishmas in Northern Ireland. I was Commander of the Land Forces, Coastal Protection Driver at the time, General Jeeps, he was SAS. And they were talking about Britishmas and said, what would you like to do? I was, oh, you said you're a German speaker. And well, you should get yourself to Britishmas. And that's how I got there. But yeah.
I don't know about any. Can all the guys hear? I know Mike can hear. Gene, Dave, Mike, Cookie, can you all hear? Yeah. I mean, obviously, everybody's got a different story.
We've got to remember that the organisation was unique in its own right. The people there were chosen specifically to do that particular job. I mean, when I went up, it just opened my eyes as to how, you know, it changed from being a normal grunt, if you like, a normal driver, okay, driving, you know, fuel or whatever we did at 8 Reg, to join in this unit that were literally jam-packed with specialists, yeah, and they were intelligent people, if I may say so myself. You know, they I'm not blowing my own trumpet either. They were good people, yeah, and they took their job very, very seriously. You know, the tour officer would do their bit, the tour senior NCO would do their bit, and the driver had to do their bit. And if you went out and you didn't have a piece of equipment, you weren't staying at Bricksmith. So it was, you know, everybody relied on each other, and you had to know what your duty was inside and out.
The reports we got written as well by Jerry Groom, rest in peace.
Yep.
Absolutely. Said you were operating in hostile conditions for almost the whole year, sort of thing. So those reports, when they went back to Glasgow to Records, was, wow, these are Bricksmas operators. Yeah, we were drivers, but we were all operating together in a team. We were working with people who were from, we're not mentioning names, but Force Research Unit, which is where I came from as a driver, which is a human intelligence gathering unit in Northern Ireland. So there was operators from there. There was 14 in operators. There was SAS, there was SBS, and they were a mixture. And then we didn't even, when you arrive there, everyone's wearing different cap badges as well. Even the intelligence corps chaps, weren't they? So, there was things like that going on and there. And that's what skills that they had within that unit. And because of the nature of the work that they were doing and collecting.
There is one interest. I don't know if anybody's read any of your books or seen some of the photos, but there is a photo of a chap on the top of a tank, and he's taking dimensions of a
barrel on a barrel.
Yeah.
BMP.
Days.
Two, wasn't it?
Do you want to explain that, Wal? That's the chap. He jumped on the top of a moving...
It was a BMP too.
Yeah.
And up until that point, we had no idea what the sort of barrel size was of it. And so one of the tour NCOs, the train, I think, parked under a bridge. And he just took the opportunity to jump down. And all he had to measure the dimensions of the barrel was an apple. So he jumped on the front of the BMP too. And stuffed the apple onto the front of it, and what came out, of course, was the measurement of the gun barrel, and it's well documented. You can read about it on the internet, and even the guy's name has been published. So, but it was another one of those opportunity things that you just had to make a split second decision if you were going to do it, and. And that was it. It was almost a who dares wins sort of moment. And, they either come off or they didn't. But as somebody said there earlier, as a crew, it was always a complete decision on all three of you what you were going to do, because your lives in a number of times depended on it. And so there was no question of the tour officer, bullying his way through and getting the rest of you to do what he wanted, because... As I say, your lives depended on it, and so it was very much a team effort, and as it always should have been.
the officers were normally fighter pilots who could speak Russians as Russian as well, and Russian speakers as well. Sandy said they sat in the middle at the back. And then the tour NCO was a senior NCO or a warrant officer from the RAF. They were mostly masters, were at least master aid load masters, master aid engineer ops and everything. And then the drivers were all, well, from a various, there was radio operators, there was staff car drivers, there was HGV drivers, everything mixed, close protection drivers all mixed. So it's a whole load of experience there, like we say, working together. And we all had to do the same recognition courses and the same photography course at Ashford.
So there used to be a thing called tarpology, which I know would bring a smile to a lot of people, but tarpology was basically a number of, you basically had to be able to recognize a piece of Soviet equipment or East German equipment for that matter that was hidden by tarpaulins. Yeah, so you'd get a flash of a little bit of a wheel or the end of the barrel or it might be whatever it may be. Okay, and you had to recognize that because inevitably on the rail flats, a lot of the time the Soviets would cover their equipment. Okay, so you'd have to recognize what piece of it, yeah, as we referred to it as at the time.
Eagle eyes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Corky would do all recognition.
And we used to have to do morning, was it every morning? Every morning.
Yeah,
chief test.
Corky can probably tell you about that, about recognition.
We used to run a thing called chief's test every morning, and then I think it was once a week or once a month, it was an extended one that was even longer. And it wasn't really to catch people out, although that did happen occasionally.
Yeah, it was.
But it was always some cool equipment. Just saying, remember, this is what a T-55 is, for those that have forgotten those days. And this is what we're looking for on T-80s as they came through and things like that. And then there'll be other parts where you would just show perhaps the rear lights and nothing else, which is where the tarpology part came in. It was quite funny sometimes, you know, because, as I say, the aim was not to catch people out until I managed to catch myself out one day. Because being a bit vain, I had decided to stop wearing glasses and got myself contact lenses. And the very first chief's test that I ran with contact lenses on, I couldn't actually see the slides myself. Walk up to the screen every couple of seconds and see what it was that I had actually put up there. No, the chief's test, you had to do well on it. And if you didn't do well, then it was noted and you would be given some advice on how to improve your recognition techniques. And sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes that would mean stopping touring for a little while. But that was quite uncommon. Most people were really, really good. And of course, the images that we were using were ones that were subsequently passed down through Ryan Dallin and through what was then Jarek, to be put into publications so that things like recce troops and such like could use those same images. And they would be able to start recognising equipment. It was quite a useful exercise.
The Jarek book is over there on the table, and the chief test original slides, Corky. somehow they've managed to appear, Corky. The chief slides are over there as well. From the actual chief's test, so you can pick them up. They're on that table and have a look through them. You'll see I've taken Miss DDR out because there was Miss DDR test as well. And we used to have on the front, taking her out.
This DDR we didn't talk about because, first of all, it was nearly always won by the Air Force. because, of course, they had a better eye for various...
Not the drivers.
They used to bathe naked. In the East Germany, the Germans, and somehow managed to get into our photos. Pull that out. We're not imagining quite a funny story, actually. At the end, things were a bit more relaxed at the end, and we went on a tour, and I can't remember who the tour officer was, but they'd said, yeah, you can go in and swim now. And I think it was, can't remember who was swimming, but there's two of us, and we went in, and of course, we were skinny dipping, and they took pictures of us coming up, which we didn't realise, yeah. And that was all over the board as well, so it set us up for that. But that was unusual.
I think it was Mal Gidling that used to win several years in the tours, actually. And I'm convinced to this day that their tours focused more on this DDR than anything that was actually flying at the time.
Yeah.
Has anybody else got any questions that they'd like to ask? So it's driving. What additional driving qualifications or courses?
We have to go to Latin Fields, which is the defence driving school.
Attached driving course, which
lasted three weeks. But the funny thing there is, all the new drivers there in uniform and all that, then you get these corporals coming in or whatever, just coming in jeans and all that, and you just get stared at all the time, wondering what. No.
Who
are these people coming in? So we went and we did the driving course for 3 weeks on various different cars. We're doing fast driving. We got special permits from the school, and we were told to go somewhere, and you have to be at somewhere at Pacific time. And you went with a crew, and you were given carte blanche really which way you went. I know one time we went from Lackenfield all the way to Tea Bay, which is like near the cross country. And we had to be there in a certain time. And with these cards, you were given exemption. That was one of the courses. The other course we had to do, which was everyone that had to do, was before you joined Brixford. It was a 4-week course down in Ashford. We went and we had no recognition. Couldn't recognise a Soviet truck. By the end of the 4 weeks, you should recognize anything.
That's all the pink books you see over there, isn't it?
You have to memorize every single photo, piece of equipment. A piece of equipment, maybe just a basic one, but there's so many different variants. It could have an extra aerial on, so that'd be a variant. And you have to know all the different variants of that vehicle as well. And that lasted 4 weeks.
That was good training. So yeah, when you get there though, wasn't it? Because they'd try and get pictures from the each side and the top, which is the fun bit, isn't it? Because we got to chase after it. So we'd be parked up at night time at a railway side, a railway crossing where the barriers come down, and they come down and go up. And the flash, we've got a curry on in our pot, the rubber bits ready. And then, all right, there's kit tray. Pack your curry away, put that down by the side. Driver's like, here we go, we're going to get a good chase now, aren't we? And I've got one of the photographer's little measurement, remember the little spot?
Yeah,
the map reading things over there, you can see. And it was a bit like rally driving. The tour NCO would then get his map out and that audio, and they would then measure it on here and say, right, 0.2 km, you're going to turn right. We'd go bombing down the road. Once it's gone through, it's been obviously from the right hand side. Now we've got to get over the bridge to the road to the other side ahead of the train. So we're racing this train now to get across the other crossing so we can get a picture from that. And then ideally, if you were lucky, you could get it to the top of a bridge. So like Dave saying, one little pintle, one little different aerial meant it was a different, different variant of whatever it was. MTLVU was a common one and that, and different armors on all the T-72s and the T-80s at the time. So that was the best, most exciting stuff for us.
The other thing that we used to have to do as well as drivers as well, on arrival at Brixmas, we were given another, I think it was 2 weeks in situ training. And that was basically a simulation as to what you would come across. So for example, you'd be told to go down in the place called the Grunewald, which is the Grunewald, and it was basically a large forested area in Berlin. And you'd go down there and you would get bumped, if you like, jumped by your own people, of course. And it'd simulate, for example, the Kommandantura, who would, detained a vehicle to go through the processor. So you're pretty much in the know as to what, you should be doing. But as I say, when I went on my very first tour with Captain Tim Townley, bless him, rest in peace, Tim, again. I was straight in the middle of a Warsaw Pact exercise, and I was out for about 12 days. I just couldn't believe it, seriously. I thought that it was like this all the time. And of course it was. So,
The driver who was leaving, though, was Paul Bunks was leaving. I was coming, so he would take you out. And like Kev says, we were driving along, and they said, is it anything suspicious? I'm like, what? Because he just told me to drive down the woods and drive down the woods. And I said, no, there's another one of our wagons behind this. I went, well, what are you going to do? That's one of our wagons. I went, right, you're being followed. I said, it's a game, is it? So here we go. So we're being followed. I just come down. I was teaching close protection at the time, so I was quite good at evasive driving, J2s and brake turns. And I was a bit cheeky as well. I think I was the youngest by about 7 or 8 years when I was like, who's this guy coming here? Especially the RAF lads who were
like, I remember as well is that the tour senior NCO, they never let an officer loose with a map. Yeah, it's just an army unwritten rule. Yeah, but a senior NCO, of course, and warrant officers included, was given the task of map reading. And for example, it never failed to amaze me the accuracy by which they knew areas that the senior NCO, and you would never question. Yeah, a senior NCO, Tory senior. If he said go left, you went left. Okay. And they, for example, you'd be in a wood and you'd drive on, I don't know, one side light, or even with night vision goggles on, as we referred to earlier, even the Mark ones, and they'd be going right 10 meters or 10 yards left. They used to have a trip master. So trip, yeah, 10 yards left again, left again, left again. And there you go. You have a nice little Z-plats, as we used to refer to it as. Yeah, which was where the guys used to get the kennel tents out, and they stayed overnight, and then stayed out overnight in luxury while we had to rough it in the G-Wagon.
Did you have more detailed maps then than that?
Yes. They had the one in 50s, I believe. Like, they had the one in 50,000 maps, or one in 25,000?
Yeah, 50,000. One in 50,000. If you were... You know, for doing a close target recce.
Yeah.
But 150,000 was the main one. We had six fanfold maps in the vehicle, which covered basically the whole of East Germany.
Yeah.
And so you just use those all the time.
Yeah.
And that's
It's worth pointing out, Dave, that you remember that the way it sets of maps, the maps went north to south, and the way they were folded, they were concertina.
That's right.
So you could follow east and west continuously on the map strips. And only when you get to the bottom, I mean, there's an old saw about all wars are fought at the corner of four map sheets uphill in the rain. Well, the maps in East Germany were not quite the same. You were able to go east-west very easily. And we had a bit of overlap at the bottom and the top. Yeah. So that when you went to the next strip, north or south, you were able to follow on. But the beauty of being able to concertina the maps was that you weren't continually pulling sheets out of the bag.
Yeah.
You would take as many sheets as you needed. I don't know whether Andy's mentioned it, but there were three sectors in East Germany, latterly, after an incident involving people stirring up the opposition. And you wouldn't know where you were going, so you would take the strips that applied to your particular task. But can I go back to recognition for a second? Because there's some interesting little wrinkle in the late 80s that some will remember. When the British Army and other allied nations were introducing thermal imaging rangefinders and viewers in their armored vehicles, and of course they hadn't seen Soviet or Warsaw Pact vehicles through a thermal imaging scope before. So we were given the mission a number of very, very large, very bulky, and extraordinarily sensitive thermal imaging devices to take out to obtain imagery of the Russian vehicles. There was a bit of a problem with this. The first is that in those days, thermal imaging wasn't what you see today, where you could buy it off the shelf. They were fairly complex equipments, and they had to be kept extremely cold, which meant you had liquid oxygen in pressurized vessels, which had to be attached to the equipment before you cooled it to get the imagery. And the larger concern for the tours, and I'd like to echo everything that was said earlier about it being a team effort, and the larger concern, and the drivers are the unsung heroes of the mission, I think, but the larger concern of thermal imaging was that you could have nothing intervening between the sensor you were using and the equipment you were trying to image, which meant that it was an absolute sin in the mission, unless you were completely content that you were secure, to have the windows in the vehicle down. So you can imagine we're on the edge of a training area on a tactical route on the side of a road where we expect equipment to be moving, and we have to wind the windows down to image the equipment, which is relatively close. So there was a definite sense of unease about some of those missions. But we did get imagery that went on to be used at the Armored Corps Center and elsewhere to train our crews on recognizing Soviet equipment through thermal imagers. And my corporate won't remember much of that, I think.
Yeah, because one of the tours that I had done long before Christmas was at Jarrow, and the orange book that you referred to earlier, it was being used to produce those, the earlier versions of it at that time. And there was actually a huge debate about whether we could keep the classification of the orange book, which I think was restricted. Could we keep it down and still put in thermal images, black and white? And in fact, possibly the debate went away when the war came down, because thermal imaging then became relatively common, just coincidentally, at the same times. I've been involved in that debate even before coming to Brixmas, because my previous posting, I had been an embassy posting in the Near East, and we had been issued a thermal imager, which was antiquated, quite frankly, compared to the ones that had come to the mission. And the end result was we were essentially told we could not get them out of the embassy. So any imaging was done had to be done from the roof of the embassy, which was totally impractical, of course. And we never did anything with it at all. But the imaging was terribly, terribly sensitive, that type of imaging. The other thing about imaging was, of course, that some of the people in the mission had had experience of tactical and strategic imagery analysis, and particularly the in-court bodies who were in there. So they had looked, for example, at satellite imagery back in, let's say, the early 80s. And now, satellite imagery then, the resolution was relatively poor. But now they were looking at this stuff, first of all, on 6-inch company imagery, which was corridor imagery taken at that time by the Benbrook aircraft, which had all been written about in the books about the corridors. And gradually we were working down to see how of these images taken by handheld on the ground. And the beauty was that realistically we could make that essentially a part of that. So if you were releasing images of things that had been seen perhaps 10 years before in central Russia and were known about by the DIS, but couldn't be talked about down to the troops on the ground, essentially. And that was part of the importance of the handheld images from the mission, was that you could then start talking about these things they were seeing so many years later.
But there was a trap, wasn't there, Mike, to the fact that the tech section would know about equipment perhaps appearing that couldn't share that with the tourists. I'm going to tell a story now about, I guess, myself. And it involves missile launchers. Now, the Tech Inc. section had known, I think for some time, that the Russians were suspected of having introduced a new mobile missile system, the SS-23. But they were not able to share that with tourists because they wanted to have a genuine encounter, which would be decisive. Well, the only issue is we were very familiar with a system called the SS-21, which was a 3-axle, 6-wheeled, bolt-shaped missile launcher. And on the occasion in question, I was sent with a very capable team to an area in the south of the DDR, which was used quite routinely for missile troop deployments. And suffice to say, to cut a long story short, after a very cautious approach, we decided that we would, and again, let me emphasize again something that was said earlier. Dave, I think, mentioned that he's absolutely spot on. All decisions in a tour crew were taken as a team, that there was no bullying or use of rank. And in fact, I mean, we always used to say that with a brigadier general in charge, often disappearing into the DDR for days at a time with just two other people, he had the best command in the British Army because he was completely free of concerns and communications. Anyway, back to the missile launchers. We had decided that, having checked that both ends of this area, which is a wooded area, with a tactical trail winding through, were free of sentries, we would give it a shot and drive straight. We knew there was activity. We heard activity, including the horn that we knew from experience signaled the erection of a missile launching rail on these things. So we decided that we'd take a run right through the area, nice and gently. Don't excite people. They might not notice you're not Russian. And we got almost all the way through and saw this missile launcher and a couple of others to one side, getting great imagery, which was all well and good. I'll go into that in a second. But came to a winding curve in the trail, which was full of water. And not unreasonably, our driver, and I won't mention his name, decided that the best place to take the turn was on the outside. Well, unfortunately, it was the same turn all Russians had decided they'd take during the week, and we got stuck in this turn, despite the best efforts of the vehicle and the driver. With water up to the windows very nearly. Surrounded almost immediately by some very excitable Russians who had to be persuaded to lower their weapons. But in any event, you know, we were happy, we'd got imagery, and they were good enough to back up to the vehicle to make sure we couldn't get out. A low truck with a missile warhead box on the back with all the designators, which was something we were very keen to get. I mean, it told us exactly what it was, where it was, where to come from. Anyway, out of the area, with the imagery, very excited, got on the phone, which we could do. We could call the mission house and pass on information. And told them, we thought we had something interesting. Anyway, come back, photographs are on the desk, debriefing, we got SS-21. And it wasn't for a couple of days that somebody looked at them again and said, but hang on, SS-21 has three axles, this has four.
And we're going to leave you on that cliffhanger to find out exactly what Mike has discovered. Do tune in next week. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening and see you next week.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. by becoming a monthly or annual supporter. You'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.